I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, should the United States be taking a different approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict? A new paper from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace argues it should, not only on moral grounds, but also for the sake of U.S. foreign policy objectives as outlined by the Biden administration, as well as for reasons related to U.S. national security and civil liberties. Said paper argues that neither a one-state or two-state solution to the conflict is currently possible, and as such, it would be best for the United States to shift towards a human rights-centric approach to the conflict. Joining us to discuss this paper is one of its co-authors, Palestinian human rights lawyer Zaha Hassan. So without any further ado, let's get right to that conversation with Zaha Hassan on the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace paper, Breaking the Israel-Palestine Status Quo. Welcome to Parallax Views. Zaha Hassan, a guest that I've really been wanting to have on the show since reading a policy paper that she helped co-author from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That policy paper is entitled Breaking the Israel-Palestine Status Quo. We're going to get into that. But first, how are you doing today, Zaha?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's nice to be with you. Thanks for inviting me here.
So in regards to this paper, I guess first we should get into what exactly the Israel-Palestine status quo has been up to this point.
We all know it pretty well, probably. For the last 30 years, we have heard that the U.S. supports a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine quote-unquote conflict, which would end the many decades of Israel's occupation since 1967 over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, and would provide self-determination for Palestinians and resolve all the what they call final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians. And these are basically the water, equitable sharing of water resources. It would involve the settlement issue, how to dispose of or incorporate settlements as part of a state of Palestine, or figuring out what citizenship status settlers would have or whether they would be evacuated. It would involve the status of Jerusalem and the ways in which the parties would share the capital or divide Jerusalem as a capital. And it would involve the Palestinian refugee issue, the refugees that were created by Israel in 1948 when Israel was founded. Around 3/4 of the Palestinian population was forced out of their homes and property for the creation of Israel to create a majority Jewish state at that time. So basically the idea was that the U.S. was going to help shepherd this peace process forward, and get to a two-state solution. But what ended up happening was the U.S., in order to encourage Israel to participate in the peace process, had to, you know, leave on the sidelines international law and human rights concerns. Otherwise, Israel was not interested in participating as the party that is in control of the land area and is the only party that is a sovereign state between Israel and Palestinians. It had the upper hand, and it didn't want to, you know, relinquish that upper hand unless it was given certain guarantees by the mediator, which was the U.S. And so what happened over time is basically the two-state solution was undermined because the U.S. provided political cover for Israel at in international fora like the UN Security Council, like the International Criminal Court, and with third-party states to prevent accountability to enable Israel to continue to participate in the peace process. And it also provided Israel with billions of dollars in security assistance, totaling in present day numbers more than $200 billion of security assistance to Israel that had no conditions and no strings attached, which enabled Israel to entrench its occupation. And on the flip side of it, with the Palestinians, there was extreme amount of conditions placed on any kind of assistance for Palestinians, U.S. Economic assistance, to guarantee that the Palestinians would fit the image of the good peace partner, which meant that they would have to provide security coordination with Israel even while they were still under occupation. And so what happened over the years, basically, is you went from a situation where you had, you know, a little over 200,000 settlers in 1993 when the peace process began, to the present day situation where you've got over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in occupied West Bank, and the two-state solution is completely eroded. And then you have the situation of gross human rights abuses happening against Palestinians, because settlements aren't just about building housing for Jewish Israelis. Settlements are about forcibly displacing Palestinians from their homes and property, undermining their productive capacity by destroying their agriculture. And you know, it involves extrajudicial killings. It involves fragmenting Palestinian communities, isolating Gaza in order to keep the demographic balance that Israel wants for its greater Israel plans. And so it's an incredible amount of violence. And the U.S. becomes implicated in all of that because of the fact of its political and financial cover that it provides. So that's basically what the paper is about. It's about looking back at what has happened over the last three decades, but it's also about looking forward and thinking about what can we do now? What makes sense for U.S. policy now, knowing what we now know about the warped incentive structure that we created as U.S. Mediators, and how can we change that trajectory?
So in regards to that warped incentive structure, because that has come up in a lot of the interviews that you and Daniel Levy and others involved with the paper have done, what are some specific examples of the warped incentive structures that we're talking about here?
Well, let's talk about the Palestinians, because I talked a little bit about the Israelis. But so the Palestinians basically were told, we want you to be a good peace partner, and we want to help you become a democratic state. We want you to build institutions that are representative and legitimate. Okay, that's what we said we wanted from the Palestinians. But what did the U.S. policy do? Laws were passed that basically told Palestinians that the U.S. was going to punish them if they implemented certain democratic choices that were made during elections. And so it reinforced the already, the already existing autocratic tendencies within Palestinian governance and amplified them and reinforced them through financial, you know, the carrot of financial assistance to the PA, but also the political legitimacy that the U.S. gave to the Palestinian Authority, the PA, and the PLO. So if the Palestinians didn't adhere to the restrictions that were placed on it, it basically was out of the game of peace processing, and it was left on the margins and delegitimized. And we saw this really starkly during the Trump administration. The Trump administration, when the Palestinians finally said, okay, we're not going to engage anymore with the United States on the issue of negotiations with Israel, the U.S. response was, okay, well, we don't need a relationship with you anymore at all. Please leave, close your mission and leave the United States, it said to the Palestinian representative. And it then cut off all financial assistance, not only to the Palestinians, but also to the international organizations supporting Palestinian refugees over the years until a durable solution is found. So the U.S. basically sanctioned the Palestinians for not engaging in a peace process in which the U.S. had already chosen one side, Israel, and decided all final status issues that I discussed earlier in its favor. So that's what that and so what did that produce? It didn't get us to a peace agreement. Actually, it emboldened Israel, because now Israel realizes that it doesn't need to make any compromises with the Palestinians, because it can just tell the mediator exactly what it wants in terms of the territorial lines between Palestinians and a greater Israel, and the U.S. will execute it for it through a peace to prosperity plan that the Israelis helped design. So the peace to prosperity plan was basically designed by Israel and executed by the U.S. Why should Israel negotiate in good faith when they have a mediator that's willing to pursue all the all of its positions and is going to disregard Palestinian consent? There is no need for Palestinian consent, because the U.S. and Israel have already decided all of the final status issues. But what it did for Palestinians is it delegitimized their leadership, and it delegitimized the whole concept of a negotiated solution in which the U.S. is a mediator, because Palestinians are looking at this and they're saying, well, obviously the U.S. mediation is one-sided. There's no doubt about it now under the Trump administration, but it was there. The accommodation of Israel's territorial ambitions was always a part of U.S. mediation. It wasn't something specific to Trump, but Trump made it much more heavy-handed and much more blatant. So it undermines Palestinian leadership and its national institutions. It shows them as being corrupt because they are accepting positions that enable them to remain in power, and their whole legitimacy vis-a-vis the U.S. is predicated on its participation in a peace process that is completely advantageous to Israel and its positions and disadvantageous to Palestinians. And so that is the warped incentive structure when you look at it from the Palestinian side. And on the Israeli side, basically, you know, if you're providing political cover for Israel, even while it's expanding settlements, even while it's displacing Palestinians, and you're also providing security assistance, which enables it to maintain and entrench its military occupation, obviously, Israel has no incentive to negotiate, and it creates a disincentive to negotiate towards a final status solution. What it does is it encourages them to participate in a process, but it doesn't encourage them to actually see it through to conclusion, because the longer they can drag it out, the longer they can have to colonize the West Bank and take more and more territory. So this was the problem on both sides, the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, that got us to this point now where we have Israeli government coalitions to the extreme right, and you have incredibly autocratic Palestinian leadership that is growing more and more illiberal and delegitimized by its people.
The term I see thrown around a lot is that we've sort of taken this Israel-centric approach, and maybe we need to move towards a more just a human rights based approach, a human rights for all, both Palestinians and Israelis, and especially because it seems like there's no viable path forward for a two-state solution or a one-state solution at this current moment in time.
That's correct. I mean, we don't have an Israeli leadership that's at all interested in a two-state solution. And we don't have an Israeli public that's interested in a meaningful two-state solution. They're much more comfortable with a status quo or just completely officially annexing the occupied West Bank. So what we're left with at this point is, you know, what should U.S. policy do? We now have multiple legal organizations and scholars talking about Israeli officials committing the crime of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. What is the U.S. responsibility at this point, given the U.S. role as mediator and facilitator of Israeli policies up to this point? Clearly, if the U.S. maintains this no daylight policy between it and Israel, it becomes more and more complicit in what's taking place on the ground. This last episode of escalated high intensity violence between Israel and Palestinians, both in Gaza, but throughout throughout historic Palestine between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. This latest episode, what we saw was just how Israel's regime is employed against all Palestinians, regardless of their citizenship, regardless of where they're living, whether it's Gaza or the West Bank or inside of Israel. And we see that the human rights situation is really egregious, and the U.S. has to signal at some point where it stands with respect to all this. During the violence, what we saw was the U.S. trying its very hardest, you know, to talk about what was happening as two sides need to de-escalate. There's two sides to the story, and both of them need to de-escalate hostilities. But that's not how we should understand the situation on the ground. The situation on the ground is one of apartheid. It's institutionalized. The Israeli Knesset has passed constitutional-based law that inscribes that Palestinians have no right to self-determination anywhere Israel lays down its sovereignty. That's as clear as you can get about the way Israel feels about Palestinians living within historic Palestine. It doesn't matter if you're a refugee, you have no right to live in the land in which your ancestors lived and which you were forced out. If you're a Palestinian citizen of Israel, you could be denationalized because you have no right to self-determination inside of Israel. And if you're a Palestinian living in the occupied territories, you have no right to stay there if Israel decides to incorporate those areas into the state of Israel. So what's the U.S. responsibility at this point? The only thing the U.S. can do, because clearly there's no ability to negotiate at this point between the Israelis and Palestinians, what the U.S. responsibility has to be to preserve and protect rights. Why? It's not just because it's the moral and ethical thing to do. It's because it's U.S. policy generally. Even this Biden administration has said it wants to center values and normative frameworks in the way it approaches foreign policies, particularly after the racial justice protests following George Floyd's killing. There was a growing understanding by folks that are now in the Biden administration that there's a connection between domestic policy and foreign policy, and there should be some framework that guides us, whether it's in how we approach problems that we're facing in the U.S. or those that we want to engage with abroad. And to exceptionalize Israel, as the U.S. is trying to reimagine its role in the international legal order, to exceptionalize Israel as it's doing that, going through that process, is only going to undermine U.S. global leadership. It's only going to undermine these institutions that the U.S. says it wants to reinvigorate. And so for that reason...
If I could, real quick, I just wanted to add, what you're saying is in line with, you know, we've heard a lot about reestablishing the U.S.'s role and beliefs in an international rules-based order. Both Biden and Blinken have talked about that. And I think this paper is in line with, you know, those ideals.
Absolutely. I mean, this should be a no-brainer for the Biden administration on what it should do. It's already taking this approach in other contexts when it talks about China and the Uyghurs, when it talks about Saudi Arabia and its human rights abuses, when it talks about Egypt and its human rights abuses. It has one language. But then when we get to talking about Israel, we all of a sudden hear a different sort of language about self-defense and about both sides. And we are not focused on the root causes anymore of what the situation is. We're talking about palliative measures for Gaza, for example, reconstruction assistance and humanitarian aid. And we're not talking about what the underlying cause is for the violence, which is the blockade, which is the occupation, which is the denial of refugees their right to return to their homes and property inside of Israel. 70% of Gaza Palestinians are refugees from 1948. And so we aren't hearing the same kind of talk and conversation about Palestinians and their relationship to Israel as we do in other contexts. But absolutely, the approach that we have in the Carnegie US MEP paper, co-authored by Daniel Levy, myself, Hala Kerr, and Marwan Mu'ashar, is to say that, no, we need to be consistent if we really hope to reestablish U.S. global leadership, if we hope to reestablish a rules-based international order that respects multilateralism and multilateral institutions. Israel has to be a part of that process of reimagining U.S. global leadership. And by the way, it's not just important for U.S. global leadership and respect for normative frameworks. It also would help to actually resolve the conflict down the road. Because if you dismantle this warped incentive structure by protecting and preserving rights, then you also will be discouraging bad actions by Israel, for example. Because if Israel knows that it's going to be held to account in the UN Security Council, if it knows it's going to be sanctioned in third countries and in the US for its settlement products, and it won't be able to market its settlement products because it will be denied markets. If it is held accountable for its war crimes in the International Criminal Court, it's going to adjust its behavior and it's going to feel more inclined over time to then start to negotiate with Palestinians in good faith. Similarly, if the U.S. stops punishing Palestinians for agency, for approaching the UN to support the two-state solution or for trying to become a member state of the UN, stops punishing Palestinians for going to the International Criminal Court, Palestinians will have more respect for their leadership. They'll become more legitimate because they'll actually be pursuing policies that actually uphold Palestinian rights. So they'll have more support in their own communities. It will strengthen Palestinian leadership so that it can participate in negotiations with Israel and have the backing of the people, which you need in order to sign an agreement. So in all respects, it's not just supporting values and human rights for the values and human rights sake as something that we all aspire to. It actually will help the peace process, and it actually will help the U.S. in its larger mission of reestablishing itself within the international community.
So one of the things I really wanted to get to in this conversation, I know that this policy paper, it's of course written for people that are interested in policy, the nitty-gritty international law, for, you know, sort of everyday people who may be listening to this show, you know, just the average American listening. Why should they be concerned about the current approach to how the U.S. deals with Israel-Palestine, and why should they be maybe thinking about why a new approach is necessary? And I guess in that regard, how is this issue and taking a new approach important to U.S. national security?
Yeah, absolutely. We as Americans need to pay attention to the Israel-Palestine issue. Because of the way in which the U.S. is so complicit in everything that's happening on the ground in Palestine, I mentioned earlier security assistance. I mean, we've provided Israel in present dollars, you know, $239 billion worth of security assistance. We provide Israel $3.8 billion per year in security assistance. And a lot of that is untraceable and untrackable. So Israel can use that in ways in which we can't hold it accountable for. And so thinking about it as an American, knowing that aid is being used for human rights abuses as documented by organizations like Human Rights Watch and the UN and Israeli human rights organizations, I would think that money could be better spent in the U.S., first of all, given that we are coming out of an economic recession produced by the pandemic, and we have a lot of agenda items domestically that we could be using that money for. And taking it out of the Israeli account would force Israel to make some important choices moving forward about its policies toward Palestinians and its maintenance of its military occupation. So as an American, I would care about this, even if I'm not following in day-to-day activities on the ground in Israel-Palestine, because it affects me as a taxpayer to be sending that kind of money. But it's not even just money to Israel. We actually provide grants to Egypt as well, over $1 billion a year to Egypt, because we want Egypt to maintain peace with Israel. Our entire policy in the Middle East is highly centered around Israel and Israeli security, which doesn't necessarily align with U.S. security many times, as we saw over the years in our Middle East policy, whether that had to do with Iraq and U.S. actions against Iraq, or whether that had to do with Syria and the Israeli position on Syria versus what the Obama administration's policies, or even with Iran, as we saw under Obama, and currently Israel strongly opposes the U.S. Re-entering the Iran nuclear deal. And so, you know, we need to really rethink our approach because of the fact it impacts Americans in their daily lives in terms of our investment in maintaining that. Now, think about it also in terms of the fact that, you know, we are one of the high ticket items or high priority items for the U.S. is pursuing Arab normalization with Israel. Arab normalization with Israel is not popular among the Arab public. And the Arab public is strongly supporting Palestinian human rights. They were deeply offended and upset by Israeli actions against Palestinians in Jerusalem, particularly actions on the Haram al-Sharif and inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli police units were firing stun grenades, tear gas, and rubber-coated bullets at worshipers during the most sacred month in the Muslim calendar, in one of the most sacred spaces for Muslims. And this caused deep outrage across the Arab and Muslim world. And we know that from past experiences, U.S. policies in the Middle East can create instability and have blowback to the U.S., you know, as we saw in 9/11, for example, when people that were engaged in attacks against the U.S. were motivated by U.S. policy in Saudi Arabia and military bases there. So absolutely, this affects Americans in very direct ways. But beyond security assistance and sort of, you know, the instability from engaging or supporting Israel unconditionally with respect to security assistance, there's also the issue of the way in which our civil liberties as Americans are impacted because of the Israel-Palestine situation. We now have laws on the books in various states that require contractors with a state to take loyalty oaths if they want state contracts. loyalty oaths that say that they promise they won't boycott Israel, or for contracts that, that say that, you know, if you want to work for the state, you certify that you've never been engaged in a boycott with Israel, or that you won't do so in the future. These are obviously in violation of our constitutional rights, in particular the First Amendment. And these are slowly being attacked and reversed in the various states that have passed these laws. But you have more than 30 states that have passed laws like these. And so the Israel-Palestine conflict is really coming home and impacting just everyday Americans and impacting their rights that we hold dear in the United States. Our First Amendment rights are impacted. So there are many ways in which the issue of Israel-Palestine isn't really just a foreign policy issue. It also has become like a domestic policy issue that we need to be concerned about, because of the ways it sets precedents for how far the government can go in controlling our free speech and our civil liberties.
So there were just maybe two more things I wanted to get into. The first is, you know, this policy paper is really comprehensive. There's a number of policy recommendations in there for different sets of issues. So for the sake of my listeners, I will just say with prioritizing human rights, you know, the paper argues that, you know, it would be a good recommendation to separate the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem from the U.S. embassy to Israel. And that's just one of a number of recommendations. In terms of prioritizing human rights, are there any specific policy recommendations from the paper that you think listeners should really hone in on if they're interested in this issue?
What we say that I think is most important in this paper is that if there is not going to be a political solution, the U.S. response should not be that it has no added value in engaging in peacemaking. The U.S. response should be that while Israel continues to foreclose a two-state solution and refuses to engage in good faith in negotiations with Palestinians, then the only response that the U.S. can have is one in which it backs equal rights for Palestinians and Israelis between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And this, I think, is really very simple. It's a simple idea that if Israel wants to maintain its control and domination over the land, then it has to extend rights to all the people. And I think as Americans, this resonates with us, because we know that, you know, separate and unequal does not work. And in Palestine, what you have are, you know, two peoples, Israeli Jews and Palestinians, regardless of the citizenship status or where they are living, they live under two sets of laws. One law provides privileges and rights for one people, and another set of laws completely disenfranchises another group of people simply because of their ethno-religious identity. We know this is wrong as Americans. We've lived through points in our history that have taught us this, that this is neither sustainable, it's not ethical, and it's not going to strengthen democracy in your country. We know that. In fact, it was our experiences with African Americans and their enfranchisement that really strengthened and is still trying to get America to live up to its ideals. It's that engagement that is now enabling America to aspire to its democratic ideals. And similarly, inside of Israel, if we understand this in the U.S., then we have to understand in Israel-Palestine that the only way to move forward in the absence of a negotiated political solution that would resolve all the final status issues in accordance with international law, in the absence of that, the only answer can be that Israel has to extend equal rights to Palestinians living under their control and authority. And I think that's the most important thing that Americans can take away from this paper. And that, you know, to the extent that there's interest in engaging with policymakers on this issue, that's the message that needs to be shared with them, is that, you know, U.S. policy has to be clear. If it's disengaged on a two-state solution and understands that's not possible, then it has to be promoting equality for Palestinians living under Israeli control and authority.
So the last thing I wanted to mention, one of the reasons I thought this paper was really important and very insightful is because I think people can get bogged down in a lot of different kind of debates when it comes to Israel-Palestine. You know, people will debate, Zionism or anti-Zionism, but you guys have really honed in on, you know, let's just look at human rights and international law and making sure that human rights aren't violated. Do you think that we're moving in the right direction now? Do you see steps being taken to maybe, you know, consider some of the policy recommendations that you, Daniel Levy, and others have made in this paper? Do you think there's a sea change in the future?
I mean, look, we have a president who's talking about equal measures of, you know, security, democracy, prosperity, and freedom for Palestinians and Israelis. That sounds a lot like equality, without saying equality, right? So clearly this administration understands that this moment requires a different kind of engagement with Israel and a different kind of engagement with Palestinians than we've had and seen in the past. So I think there's already a door open for the approach that we outline and detail in the Carnegie USMEP paper. But what you don't see in the administration yet is really the level of detail and the explicit reference to international law and human rights that we set out. I think it's going to have to go there. I think the administration's going to have to go there, because especially after what we saw, you know, in April and May in Jerusalem, inside of Israel, in the occupied territories, Israel's high intensity bombardment of Gaza, more and more people are understanding there is something desperately wrong with the Israel-Palestine relationship. And there's something desperately wrong with the U.S. approach, the historical approach, an approach that still talks about Israeli self-defense as dozens of Palestinians are being killed with, you know, one-ton bombs that take down entire apartment buildings like a house of cards. And I think we saw that in terms of the members of Congress, the discomfort, not just from progressive corners of the Democratic Party, but from, you know, Israel stalwarts like Senator Bob Menendez, who, you know, wrote this letter demanding really a ceasefire and really questioning Israel's use of force against buildings that were housing media like the Associated Press and Al Jazeera News. So I think that Israel's heavy-handed policies aren't going to change anytime soon. We are seeing a new coalition government that looks like it's going to push out the current prime minister, but in favor of what? In favor of Naftali Bennett, who will be the first prime minister if all goes well with the coalition, and his views on Israel-Palestine peacemaking are much to the right of Netanyahu. So this issue is going to continue. You're going to see further attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem, further displacement in Jerusalem, and the U.S. is going to have to decide whether it wants to maintain a policy that says that there should be no daylight between it and Israel, or whether it's going to really pursue equal measures of freedom, you know, security, prosperity, and democracy for both Israelis and Palestinians moving forward.
And just maybe with regards to a bigger picture here, I just wanted to get your take on this because I had just thought of it. I feel like we're in a cultural moment especially in light of things like Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests, and also just the protests we saw after what happened in Sheikh Jarrah. I think we're at a moment, especially with young people, where people are considering international law and human rights a lot more. I think for years there was a lot of propaganda attacking international law, or, you know, sort of partisan attacks on things like the UN. And I think that, you know, those kind of attacks aren't working anymore. People are considering the importance of things like the UN and international law more. I just wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think we're still a very polarized country. You know, we still have that sort of 60-40 divide. But I do, what I am seeing is that the issue of Palestine, Israel is now become embedded among a package of other issues that are important to liberals and progressives generally. And it's in this package of issues include things like racial justice, include things like, you know, a foreign policy that respects human rights and international law and multilateralism. It thinks about economic equality and inequality and how to remedy that. I mean, there's a myriad of issues and they all intersect in important ways. And what's different in this moment is that we're starting to see that interconnectedness in a way that we haven't in the past. And more people, because of social media, because of really important organizing that has been taking place over the years within the progressive movement, you're starting to see an electorate that's much more savvy about these things these days and knows how to work together and coordinate in ways that weren't possible just because of limitations that we had in terms of media access. But now we've moved beyond that with social media. And I feel that a whole new world of possibility has opened up. And yes, international law, human rights are very much centered as sort of guiding principles to lead on all these issues that have now become sort of part and parcel of the progressive movement.
Well, I want to thank you again, Zaha Hassan, for coming on Parallax Views. I highly recommend everyone read the Breaking the Israel-Palestine Status Quo paper. I think it's a very important paper, and I know we couldn't get into all the little details of it, but I really think it's an important piece. Anything you want to say in closing, or let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work?
Yeah, thanks so much for highlighting the paper. I would just point to the Carnegie Endowment web landing page for the report. There's a whole lot of other resources there, articles that deal with specific issues like security assistance to Israel, like how to think about Gaza and reconstruction in Gaza. There's papers and tools there located on the website. There's a timeline that goes through the U.S.-Palestine relationship and key dates to help understand the ways in which Congress has tied the hands of the executive branch, limiting the room for maneuver with respect to peacemaking. And there's other commentaries that you can look at and learn a lot more about these issues. And there'll be things posted throughout. So that's a great place to go to keep up on the conversation around Israel-Palestine peacemaking and just to learn more.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Zaha Hassan. Please be sure to check out the paper she co-authored at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace entitled Breaking the Israel-Palestine Status Quo. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.